Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Well, hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm Nan Evans, your host for this session of Nature Now, and my guest today is Marcia Bjornerud. Marcia is a professor of geology and environmental studies at Lawrence University in Wisconsin. And Professor Bjornerud is a structural geologist. She focuses on the physics of earthquakes and mountain building. And she will be giving a talk on December 10th to the Quimper Geological Society. Now, obviously, that's going to be via Zoom. And it's titled, How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. And we'll talk more about that later. Also want to mention that Marcia is the author of a really interesting book by the same title, How Thinking Like a Geologist. Okay, if you're kind of wondering, what does this have to do with Nature Now's kind of usual general focus on regional matters? Well, I am going to say everything, and just listen in, because this does impact us. So welcome, Marcia. Thank you so much for joining us via Zoom.
It's a pleasure to be here, Nan. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go into our conversation, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, I will give you a little hint. These birds are obvious around town. I'm seeing them in my bird feeders regularly. And another little hint. These guys don't migrate very much. And the same individual bird may visit a feeder all year round. So we'll come back later in the show and identify that mystery sound. But now let's talk to Marcia. And I was trying to capture in maybe a sentence what this show might be about. And after reading Marcia's book and talking with her a bit, I think I'm settling on something like, why is an awareness of the Earth's rhythms, its rhythms in time, why is it critical to our species and planetary survival? So as an introduction, let's start with the basics. Marcia, how does a geologist think?
Well, it goes well beyond just being able to identify rocks and minerals and fossils. When I try to explain to people what I do as a geologist, I often find myself saying that the field of geology is, in some sense, a lens for seeing in four dimensions. And that would, of course, include time.
Right.
Yeah, seeing the landscape around us, not as an inert, static fact, but as a dynamic, continuously evolving thing.
You know, and that's something I think many non-geologists, myself included, don't really grasp all the time. So it's really interesting to hear you state it that way, in the fourth dimensions.
And it's not a trivial thing to learn. I've been a professor of geology now for more than 30 years. And I realize that that's probably one of the hardest metacognitive skills that we try to instill in our students. And it's something that just has to be done again and again, practice at it, and little by little one gains the capacity to see the world around you in this almost cinematic way as something that is continuously changing and responding to elemental forces around it.
Let me ask you another just kind of brief question. As a geologist is trying to grasp what has happened over time, you know, and even relatively simple questions, I say that, but probably not, as, well, how old is that series of rocks you're looking at? And you use the phrase in your book, how do geologists plumb the depth of time? So real briefly, how do you do that? What's your scientific technology?
Wow. And this is going to be a focus of my talk to the Quimper group on Saturday. Very briefly, at least in the West, until the late 18th century, so late 1700s, the biblical view of the earth prevailed. And the prevailing idea was the Earth was perhaps 6,000 years old. I should say that in non-Western traditions, there seems to have been a much greater acceptance of the idea of a very ancient Earth, although not scientifically calibrated. But we usually trace the beginning of modern geological understanding of time to a Scotsman named James Hutton in the late 1700s, who had this beautiful vision of Earth as an infinitely rejuvenating, almost cyborgic entity. And this was based on a now very famous outcrop on the east coast of Scotland that's called Sicker Point, where Hutton saw two sequences of rocks, one standing nearly vertical, and they were sedimentary rocks, so he knew that they had somehow been tilted and contorted, put on end, and then a ragged sort of surface, and then an overlying sequence of also sedimentary rocks that were more or less horizontal. And his great epiphany, which is astonishing to have had more than 250 years ago, long before we understood plate tectonics, was that that older sequence of rocks represented the eroded remnants of an ancient mountain belt. And the surface between these two sequences represented the time it would take to bevel off that mountain belt by erosion, essentially back down to sea level. Hmm. And he realized that that would take so much longer than 6,000 years, and essentially hypothesized that the Earth was infinitely old, and he was glimpsing at this particular outcrop, just one of, again, an infinite series of cycles of mountain building and erosion and rejuvenation. And so he gave us deep time, in fact, infinite time, which we now recognize is not true. The Earth is not infinitely old, but certainly by human standards, it's for all practical purposes nearly infinitely old. But in some strange way, even though Hutton is now often identified as the patriarchal figure of modern geology, he was not interested in calibrating deep time. And that really fell to the next generations of geologists. And in some ways, it's a project that continues to the present day. We continuously refine our understanding of the geologic timescale. So very briefly, the project began with looking at stratified rocks. People started looking at sedimentary rocks and knew that the oldest ones are on the bottom. And then they started seeing that fossils of certain types occurred in a very predictable sequence worldwide. So that was the beginning of being able to put together a global geological timescale, not just one that applied to any particular location. But until the early 20th century, we did not have any way of quantitatively measuring the age of rocks. And so the timescale that most people are familiar with the Cambrian or Division, Silurian, Devonian, and et cetera, to the present, is really over-representing just the most recent part of geologic time, because that's the part that was based on the fossil record. And that was put together by Victorian geologists in the 19th century and remains in the public mind kind of the geologic timescale. Everything before the rocks that had fossils in them was just lumped as Precambrian.
So give me an idea. What's the approximate age of the Earth, and when does that, the geological timescale that some of us are familiar with, but very few of us, including myself, remember, the Precambrian time, when does that start in that timescale of the Earth?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. So that would be nine zeros.
Right. I just like, it's hard to grok, yeah. But okay, 4.5 billion, right. All right.
And the Cambrian started, we'll just round it to about 500 million. So it's Everything from Cambrian to today is just the last one-ninth of Earth's history. The so-called Precambrian is eight-ninths of Earth's history. It's like the iceberg below the surface. And so we still battle this. I sometimes call it temporal dysmorphia, that even geologists sometimes, you know, because we have this sort of anachronistic nomenclature of Cambrian and then Precambrian, we forget that really most of the story is Precambrian. And many things happened, and now we have ways of calibrating that once unfathomable part of Earth's history with radioactive dating.
Yeah, the scale is just mind-boggling. Probably people are familiar with the concept of carbon radioactive dating, but I assume you must be using other minerals in decay sequences as well?
Absolutely. In fact, carbon-14 dating can only be used for objects that are no older than about 50,000 years. So it's perfectly good for archaeological purposes, but it's really not geologically very useful when we're talking about timescales of 100 million or billions of years. So yes, we use naturally occurring radioactive elements like uranium and thorium, potassium, rubidium, that occur in high enough concentrations in many minerals that they can be used as these sort of geologic clocks. And that's been done since the very, almost a few, just a few years after the phenomenon of radioactive decay was discovered in 1905. Geologists were realizing this is the key to being able to find ages of ancient rock.
Well, I mean, the scale is just completely overwhelming to me. But I will share with listeners that when I read Weird Marsh's book, again, that was, you know, thinking like a geologist, she's got a very fascinating chapter to it, talking about that those early periods, the time where most of the Earth has spent. But let's not do that today. Let's instead, when I was in school and was exposed to the geologic timescale, the most recent flicker of time in the history of the Earth was called the Holocene. And now we find we're in a different time that scientists are calling the Anthropocene. And it's a time when humans are essentially a geologic force. Marcia, can you tell us a bit about why this is its own now time period, the Anthropocene, and what's so different about it that from earlier time frames?
Right. So technically, it's not yet an official epic on the geologic timescale, but it really has entered the lexicon, both in science and the public discourse, without having had true official approval by the International Commission on Stratigraphy, which is the governing body of the geologic timescale. All of the divisions of geologic time have reference sections, outcrops, that represent the sort of definition, the tangible definition of a particular boundary in time. And so the main discussion is really, how do we define the Anthropocene? What physical place is the equivalent of sort of the, you know, the kilogram that used to be in Paris for the national standard? So that everyone uses this term, but it isn't technically part of the timescale. But there are many, many arguments that we have, in fact, entered a new chapter in Earth's history, in that humans have become geologic agents at the planetary scale. For example, our carbon emissions are greater than 50 times all of the volcanic CO2 put out every year. So we are much more affecting the atmosphere even than, say, Mauna Loa, which is in the process of erupting right now, 50 times over. We move more sediment than all of the rivers of the world combined. The extinction rates that are really our fault are at least an order of magnitude in both marine and terrestrial ecosystems than background rates of extinction in pre-industrial times. So by almost any measure you can think of, it seems that the rules have changed because of human activities.
In a lot of your writing and thinking, you use the term timefulness. What do you mean by that term?
Well, of course, that's the title of my book. And it's intentionally provocative. It sort of rhymes with mindfulness, but it's also a counterpoint to timelessness, which we often think is something to aspire to. And I'm pushing back against that idea. As a geologist, I swim every day in time. The evidence of time is all around me and all of us if we just learn to see it. So as I said at the outset, this is really what geologic thinking is about. And it's critical to our understanding of our place on the planet, both for practical reasons, because of ignorance of the rates of natural processes, the durations of different chapters in Earth's history, and how human activities are accelerating processes, that is at the heart of so many of our environmental problems. But I also think from a spiritual and psychological standpoint, not understanding our place in time as Earthlings is damaging to us. We think we are stranded on this island of now, and we're lonely as a result. We crave some sort of continuity with the past and the future, but we don't have the understanding of our place in geologic time. So to me, timefulness is a sense of continuity, that we too live in geologic time, and there is not a disjunction between the geologic past and the geologic future. We're just part of this continuing unfolding story of the planet.
I don't think many of us kind of really think that way. Our time frames are so present-oriented, or at the most, maybe a generation or so oriented. You've talked about a lot of the sort of spiritual benefits, the appreciation benefits of thinking about ourselves as really part of this very, very long, almost unimaginable history of the Earth. If we were more aware of that, what difference do you think that would make?
I have to think it would make a huge difference from the personal level to the global governance level, because every decision we would make would be framed in a completely different mindset. We are locked into by our democratic system and by our capitalistic system, very short-term thinking, as you said, you know, with two-year election cycles, annual report cycles. Capitalism encourages us to be short-term thinkers. There really aren't many mechanisms and incentives for people to be thinking on decadal, much less century kinds of timescales. And yet, that's what we most urgently need. And this chronophobia, this fear of time, I understand has many, many different origins. Some of it is quite natural, our own fear of our own mortality. Some is vanity, the capitalistic messaging that tells us that aging is bad, and all kinds of industries that benefit from keeping everyone from considering the long-term consequences of the products they sell. But in a technologically advanced world, at some point, we need to be honest about the long view and whether these kinds of blinkered ways of thinking really can continue much longer. I think everything would be different if it couldn't be denied that change happens and it's inexorable. We might as well learn to live peaceably with it.
I'm wondering, I can hear sort of a cynical voice saying, well, if we're such a minimal flicker in time in the history of the Earth, what difference will it make?
Right. And that's a very despairing view. I mean, I'm human and I care about future generations. And so it will make a huge difference to those who come after us.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
In the grand scheme of things, as a geologist, if I really zoom way out, maybe not. But it's a great tragedy to think of a species like ours that has been so ingenious in so many ways and now has all of this information at hand about how this marvelous planet has evolved and survived and rebounded and invented so many things, and that under our watch, so many of those wonders would be destroyed.
So yeah, I think that's beautifully stated. Thank you.
We need to find some middle way between that nihilistic despair and narcissistic self-absorption.
Ooh. If someone were sort of seriously interested in saying, okay, I need to challenge the way I've been thinking about time and my sort of place in the world, how do you encourage people to go about starting that?
Well, I think getting to know one's local geology, landscapes that are already familiar, whose shapes you know the shapes of the hills and the valleys, and starting to think, why are they like that? And so you, beginning with the framework of your own familiar environment, there are plenty of resources. Well, the Quimper Society probably has local geological information. Every state has its geological surveys. There are many books like Geology Underfoot in Whatever State, mm-hmm, or Roadside mm-hmm. Geology of
Whatever and I think State. Yeah.
Starting local is the way, and getting to know the names of your local rocks, and then expanding outward. For me, one of the great joys of geology is that I speak rock, which is a global language. So no matter where I go on the earth, even if I don't understand the human language spoken, I can talk to the rocks. And so it's a very empowering thing. I sometimes tell students that geology is like the etymology of the world. I've always been interested in word origins, but having a basic geologic understanding allows you to kind of unlock the origin of any place you go.
Yeah, you made a comment in, I believe it was in your book, about rock is not a noun, it's a verb. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, fascinating. Thinking of fascinating, we have actually almost run out of time. I will point listeners to two programs that we did here on Nature Now earlier this year with two local geologists looking at Tomamas Rock down near Timucum, which is a remnant of a very, very ancient volcano, older than any of the other ones that are active around here, and at Tarragon Rock, which is a glacial erratic. So I would encourage people to have a look at that, or listen to that. And I would also encourage people to join Marcia at the Quimper Geological Society talk on Saturday, this coming Saturday. It's 4 p.m. It's via Zoom. And if you go to the Quimper Geological Society website, you can find all the details. That's quimpergeology.org if you want to remember that. And of course, again, recommending Marcia Buonarroot's book, Time Fullness: How Thinking Like a Geologist Can Help Save the World. And it was published by Princeton University Press. Thank you, Marcia. Just have time to hear that mystery sound again, so let's hear it. Well, many of you probably recognized it. That was the Anna's Hummingbird. It was a recording from Cornell Ornithology Laboratory. And many of us are familiar. It's a very common hummingbird along the Pacific coast. And quoting the Cornell Ornithology Lab, they're anything but common in appearance. They're no bigger than a ping pong ball and no heavier than a nickel. And this is a quote: with their iridescent emerald feathers and sparkling rose pink throats, they are more like flying jewelry than birds. Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic, eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live, this earth. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich, and you can listen to Nature Now podcasts, this one as well as past ones, on the KPTZ website. And one more quick thing. We are a happy team of Nature Now folks. If there's anybody out there in our listening audience who would love to join this happy team in any role, no special experience other than just curiosity is needed, you can email naturenow@kptz.org. Again, that's naturenow, one word, at kptz.org. And finally, our ending music is Rock Around the Clock, recorded by Bill Haley in the Comets in 1954. Some folks consider this song more than any other to have brought rock and roll into the mainstream culture around the world. Thanks so much. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. Put your bad bags on. Join me home. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes two, three, and four, if the band slows down, we'll yell for more. We're going to rock around the clock tonight. We're going to rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're going to rock, rock.
chimes ring five, six, and seven. We'll be right in seventh heaven. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Well, it's 8, 9, 10, 11, 2. I'll be going strong, and so will you. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 12, we'll cool off and start around.